Welcome back to Chapter 2 today at Real Liberty Media. I'm Vincent Easley, and I'm reading from a book compiled by Irma Stevenson and Ozark Heritage. It's a family history of George and Ida Barnett. And there's the notifications going out. Thank you. Including Grinder, Torix, Lowrance, Guffey, Clements, and other surnames. This comes from the second edition, January 2005. The first edition was in June of 1999. This book may be produced without permission of the author. However, please give credit to the sources. Now, last week in Chapter 1, I left off just a little bit of some photos and descriptions back there. And so I'm going to build into Chapter 2 here, which will be Elby, Then and Now. And I'm going to start here about where I left off, I reckon, and that was a mule team and gentry. I'm pretty sure I covered this, but there was Ray driving and Dole at the plow behind Ray, George in front. Ray is very hard to see, so look closely. The mules were bred from two mares, Chloe and Frank. Excuse me. Now, my friend Kevin Barnett, he come by the other day, and I told him I'd done Chapter 1, and he said he hoped that I was just reading this without having pre-read anything, and I'm not. I looked at a couple little places throughout, but and he thought it'd be nice just seeing the exclamation, I reckon, that comes along with learning a few things as we go about, which I'm enjoying this immensely. This is a tale of in the history of some folks out here where I live on Half Moon Mountain in Van Buren County, Arkansas. It's the Barnett family and their descendants and those ancestors that brought it all about into being. And we go back here and look at the kids and gentry on a stone wall by Flint Creek. And you'll remember that George and Ida had moved up there from or down here in LB, Arkansas, where we're going to come to. let me just start this off with for my Yankee friends up north there. He says he's having he's maybe up to, I forget what percentage he said of understanding hillbilly here. Now I've determined to maybe enunciate with a little less southernese, but it won't happen while I'm reading this book, I'll guarantee you. But maybe I can practice some when I come back to my regular radio broadcast. Now, this right now is being compiled into the Pondergander podcast player, and when I complete it, I'll bring it all together in a series of broadcast blogs, Pondergander blogs, and I call it radio logs. Well, anyways, there's these youngins up there, and who's that? A couple of fellers and a lady there standing with them. We're hoping to bring all this in and put it to internet form where all these pictures are, so hopefully they'll bring that together. Let me go back in here. The Barnett family in 1934 with Ray, Irvy, Doyle in the middle. That's in the back, and in the middle is Iva, George, Ida, and Dora, and in the fronts, Jeanette and Geneva. And they're standing out there in the lawn with some trees in the background. And let's see. That was on page 46, and I'll go now to photos of page 48, and I was reading this in the pre-tunication here. It's a model team, and it's the first family car. The photo was taken about 1931 or 1932. From left to right is Dora, Ray, Irvy, Iva, and Doyle. Well, Irvy paid $10 and 20 bushels of corn valued at 50 cents a bushel for this car. The Model T had gravity-fed fuel, so they had to back it up a hill to keep the engine from dying. There was not enough gas in the tank and not enough money to fill it. On page 49, we've got four photographs here. And top left is Maddie, Norma Jean, Iva Lee, Patty Ida, Jeanette and Geneva, Nancy, Melissa, Wanda May, Elizabeth, and Elizabeth there, I reckon. And it's circa 1935 or 36. That's the year my dad was born. Cousin Thomas Barnett and Ray Barnett in 1937. And let's see what standing out in front of there. Looks to be a big tree stump been cut down. And then to the back and right is a big house, looks like. I don't know how big it is, but it's got a front porch there, looks to me. Now to the bottom left is Sweethearts of the Boys. It's Lorraine Hardcastle on the left, married Ray Barnett, and Eva Taylor married Irvy Barnett. And they're standing in front of an old car. And I believe this is down in Elvey. Sure enough, right in the background, I can tell that building. That's the what was the schoolhouse. And for a while was Masonic Lodge upstairs. And then eventually they had so many kids, they took the upstairs for more classrooms. And to the right, we've got Betty Jo, David Ray, and Zoe Marilyn. And the smokehouse is in the background. Some youngins. One of them, look at that little boy there. Old David Ray, he's just sitting in a little wagon. A little red wagon. I don't know if it's Radio Flyer or not. All right, turn the page. We're at page 50. And these are a bunch of baby pictures of the triplets, Geneva, Doris Jean, and Jeanette, growing up as a threesome. Now, we read last week, one of them girls, I believe, is she become an adopted member of the family and become a part two of them twins and made it a triplet. I may be wrong on that. Maybe these are three new sets of young'uns here, but I don't think I was wrong. Anyways, here we go back to chopping, sawing, and splitting wood, taken in 1937. We got Ray, Doyle, and George there in a crosscut saw, and there's he's got him a double-bitted axe in the background there, and them boys cutting wood. Somebody says, Barnett? Yes, Barnett. I'll skip ahead and I'll give you this, some of the pronunciations on that. There's a lot of variations in Barnett and Barnett. Barnett or Barnett. Yeah. Barnett, that's closer. Grammar and pronunciation. And there's variations, like I said, on the pronunciation of the name. Many, many ones and different spellings. And that's up there on the origins of the Barnett name. And we'll find as we come to this chapter 2 on Elba, it's pronounced Elby, as in Ida's name is pronounced Idy. Now, my grandma's name was Meda, M-E-D-A, but it was pronounced Meedy. So I don't know where the origin of that comes from, but I can tell you it could probably easily, somebody shoot that duck and check, could be easily found. As in commonalities like tobacco is backer, and you can see where the hillbilly pronunciation goes into even into the northeast, and then that ties to the English. So this development of the American language. Of course, we don't speak English here in America, and certainly not in the South. And in the hills, it even becomes more of a species. What would I call that? Specialized language? I don't think that's quite right. Excuse me, I have some coffee there. Wash that down with, though. Now I'll see if I can spit her back out. All right, so the Barnett family, here's a portrait taken in 1938. Front row is Geneva, Ida, George, Jeanette. And the back row is Irvy, Dora, Doyle, Iva, Ray. And I wonder if her name wasn't said as Ivy. So Iva crocheted the twins' dresses and collars for Iva and Dora. Some fine looking photo there, yeah. Golly, look at them boys. You can tell their descendants looking at them. I'll tell you what, you can see their face right there, sure enough. Very strong characteristics in the Barnetts. Hard work's one of them, too, beyond the looks of what you see physically. All right, here's the Barnett home in Gentry, taken about 1938 or 39. The back row is Ida Barnett, George, Maddie Lowrance, and Dora McKinney. Now, the Lowrances and the McKinneys live up here on 110. Their descendants do. That's a highway up here off of where my road comes down Half Moon Mountain into Fawn Bluff, and that's where I live there on Half Moon Mountain. And in the front row, we got Geneva Barnett, Jeanette, Barnett, Doris Jean McKinney, and Nancy Lowrance. And that is the home. Boy, it's a big house. Sure enough, Gentry, Arkansas. Page 54, We've got George with a new tractor on the Gentry farm, and it's a farm all. Then we've got another picture below. It's Calhoun Hardcastle Farm Supply Store in Gentry. And there's Archie Hardcastle Sr. on the left and Charles Calhoun on the right. Couple of tough looking cusses right there, and they looks like they're selling flour and feed and equipment. I bet you that store probably still there. It's been a while since I've been through Gentry, but they've got a lot of the old buildings there. Now we come to 56 is Ida in the kitchen in Gentry in 1962. Below is Ida in the hospital. And we've got a picture of her in the hospital bed with Patty visiting Ida on August the 19th of 1962. Ida was in traction for, fractured leg for 3 to 4 months following the car wreck. We remember that. It was a very tragic accident that affected George greatly. The farm was sold while she was in the hospital, and she never returned to that home. Yes, great sadness in that. And last week in Chapter 1, we read about that. And here we are to page 58. All the children, about 1940. We got back row left to right. Ray, Pauline, Doyle, Dora with the baby, Irvy, Eva, Iva, and Ed. The front row is Jeanette, Geneva, and Doris Jean. And on the bottom of that, we got George and Idy in 1964. That's the year I was born. And here's looking at you, babe. Ha ha, that's pretty. Let's see here. I think we might be coming up to run through them pictures. No, still got some more pages to go. All right, here we go. Let's see. Number page 60. That looks like a pretty nice watercolor there. Maybe it might have been acrylic or whatever other things to paint through this. But it's a picture. Looks to me the homestead up there in Gentry. Looks like that house pictured there. And I reckon that big old barn with a big oak tree in between it, where it was at. Page 61. The old barn. Yeah, that's it. Here's a picture of it. The old barn on the Barnett homestead in Gentry just before the demolition squad entered the scene. Well, they put in a big lake there where the farm used to be there on Flint Creek. We found out last week. And here's the next picture beside that. The old farmhouse is empty and run down, but still full of happy memories. Last week on a salute and a tribute to Becky Haynes passed this world, I quoted something from Longreads about the memories in that house, and we didn't know there'd be memories at the time, but maybe sometimes we know. That's some interjection there. Let's all go back to the middle picture. And the trees are gone, the lake bed is almost ready to fill. There's a house still sitting there. I reckon they'll just leave it under there. The potato cave is empty. The garage is fallen. Yeah, there's a picture of it. In the picture to the right, the bottom, is the foundation of the barn, chicken house, shed, and farmhouse, await being mercifully covered by the waters of Little Flint Creek. They built the lake there for power. But they did knock the house down. I guess there's debris laying there, though. Here comes to page 62, and it's the location of Old Barnett Farm near Gentry, and there's a map, and it became a part or buried beneath or below Swepco Lake, and here's a map, Highway 59, that's the main artery there, go up to Gravett. That's where my family's at, and then if you take a ride at Gravett, where that's from, on over into Hiawassee. So here's the Gentry Cemetery in there, and other locations and roads. And the picture at the below is Swepco Lake and Power Plant, as seen from the upper portion of the old Barnett farm where George often grew tomatoes. It's not a real big lake, reckon, but I guess it's doing what they are supposed to do. I've come to Chapter 2, Elby, Then and Now, and is what I'm going to do is come back to the recording here and just take a pause a moment, and I'll be right back. Okay, so here we go with Chapter 2 of Elby, Then and Now, and we'll start at page 66, and I'll go for 30 pages. So I don't reckon it'll be 2.5 hours as long as it was last week. It starts here with an ode to Elby. In the shadow of Half Moon Mountain, with no claim to worldwide fame, rest the remains of an old railroad town at the end of a dusty lane. Use your senses now as we wander through the town that used to be. See the lights and hear the thunder of the sound of memory. Smell the fragrance of mountain flowers and the freshness of valley air. See the bluebirds and soaring eagle, both contently nesting there. Hear the sounds of the valley around you. Warm your face in the morning sun. Let its beauty completely surround you at the glorious day is begun. I'm going to read that whole one again. Hear the sounds of the valley around you. Warm your face in the morning sun. Let its beauty completely surround you as the glorious day is begun. See the schoolhouse still a-standing, silent now for many years. But hear the echo of children. Hear their laughter, see their tears. There's the little gray house by the wayside, with a big pond in the empty field nearby. And Half Moon Creek flows gently by without change as the years roll by. Just ahead you can see the big house, which was once a busy hotel. It was truly the heartbeat of Elby, and the folks hereabouts knew it well. The old bent oak stands guard at the front door. The store building is there next door. And a trail dimly seen tells the story of a train that is no more. Hear the M&A whistle blowing. See the smoke billow in the stack. Feel the rhythm of the earth slight tremble as the train rumbles on down the track. Let's do it again. Hear the M&A address. Star thing there. Hear the M&A whistle blowing. See the smoke billow from the stack. Feel the rhythm of the Irish mighty as the earth slight tremble and the train rumbles on down the track. I messed it up twice. Okay, let's go back in here and let's put this in a mind's eye. Cross over the Little Red River where near the low water bridge it flows. Pause a while and savor the freshness of the cool river breeze as it blows. Just beyond the bridge up the river, take a short and leisurely stroll where Half Moon and Limb Creeks flow together at the swimming and fishing hole. See the chimney on the old Ormond home place across the valley, so lonely and still. Standing guard, oh, where the remnants of Elby, like a sentinel up there on the hill. And today we're creating new memories as our laughter echoes down the lane for Hallie and all his people have come back to Elby again. For a while, just a while, we'll linger. Then with happy and smiling faces, we'll each depart with a fulfilled heart, all enriched for having shared this place. That was from Marilyn Norton of Pine Bluff, Arkansas, August of 1987. M&A was the Missouri and North Arkansas Railroad. This poem was dedicated to Hallie Orman on the occasion of his 82nd birthday. The next page comes to an aerial view of Elby, Half Moon Mountain, and surrounding areas. Let's see if I find where I'm at just real quick here. And there it is. I see me right there to the right in the bottom right corner near. You see some bends in the road and a big old open field. Reckon that's got that pond I built over there on Cougar Trail. Well, I've been around stomping them hills. Let's turn the page. We're coming to page 68, and we're going to talk who is Hallie Orman. The following has been taken from Thinking by Hallie Orman of March 25th of 1985. Pioneer Spirit by Hallie Orman, 1976. She says, or he, I reckon it's a gal. I was born in Capitan, New Mexico, September 1st, 1905. We moved into the valley of Middle Fork of Little Red River to Rumley, Arkansas, near the town of Elby, Van Buren County, on May 11th, 1911, and suffered and enjoyed many of the ups and downs of living in such a country. This was only 4 or 5 years after the railroad was actually constructed through this area on its way to Helena, Arkansas, on the Mississippi River. I was coming 6 years old that fall, and there were only two children, Arthur and myself. My mother was Marianne Wedmore, the daughter of Arthur Wedmore, who was born and raised in Bristol, England. My mother was born June 20th, 1880, in Denison, Texas. Her mother died when she was only 8 or 9 years of age. The newer family of Denison, Texas, raised my mother. They gave her a fine education. She was a college graduate. She taught school in New Mexico and Arizona. She taught two terms of school in Elby during World War I, and she taught Arthur and I at home. We came out with good educations. My mother was the shining light in that country around Elby. She taught most of them to read and write, helped raise their children, and in general was the cause why so many fine people come from Elby and attained such a high standard wherever they went. They were the kind that helped build such a great country that we enjoy today. My mother also served as postmaster for a while in those days. Back in those days as postmaster, Elby received a compensation of about $8 a month. Mother passed away in 1942. My father was John Vivian Orman and was born September 34th. What? Wait, that can't be right. Must be 3rd or 4th. That got me right there. It did. Was born in September, I'm thinking maybe the 3rd or 4th, 1879, at Moran, Texas, which is about 20 miles east of Abilene. Wow. That's right over there where my cousin lives right now. And over around Boyd there and Baird. Sure enough. So, let me get back to this. I could tell you about the flu epidemic that hit us in the winter of 1917 and 18. Remember that one? Wow, that was the big flu. With little or no medical assistance. Many people died, and we had a hard time with sick trying to help take care of the sick. When warm weather finally came in May 1918, my grandma had been a year old then. In 1918, that was a really bright ray of sunshine. When I think back over those years, we made it because God was always by our side. During January 1918, it snowed every day except for January 31st. The snow attained a depth of more than 30 inches on the level. Arthur and I hauled hay on a sleigh through January and part of February to keep an old black cow from starving to death. Mama was teaching school at Elby that winter, and we were living up on the homestead, which was about 1 mile from Elby. And I kept fires going and swept the two-room schoolhouse. One room was upstairs where the Masons met about once a month. The down pasture train ran through Elby about 4:35 p.m. and dropped off the mail. On one of those cold January days in 1918... Mama received in the mail a notice from the bank at Leslie that one of Papa's notes for $1,000 was due and that something had to be done. Mama said, "Hallie, you stay here with old Spot and Arthur, and I'll walk through this snow and be at Leslie, that's 10 miles away, when the bank opens in the morning," which she did. Mama crawled across the railroad bridge across the Red River. That'd be down there in Shirley. I got pictures of that. The bridge is more than 300 foot long and high, covered... I got a dog here in the page here with the... high with snow. I'll back up for the pictures. Just let me do that now. At page 69, we got left John Vivian Orman, Hallie's father. And to the right, we got Hallie Fillmore Orman, Hallie's uncle. Pictures were taken around 18 and 86, probably in Texas. Below that, we've got a cardboard note from Mother Orman to Hallie. It says, Arvy, and we're going with Mr. B, and you be sure and tend to everything. Shut the chickens up at night and tend to everything just right, and give Mr. Kemp those papers and get 50 cents from Riley. In short, tend to everything just right. Papers are in your trunk, and be sure and go and locate that land, two homesteads, without delay, and don't neglect that. All right, turn the page. And I'm undog there. I'm not sure who turned that big old dog in there, but probably ain't supposed to be there. I'm going to open it back up. Page 70, we got brothers Arthur Vivian Orman and Haley Charles Orman on the back porch of the Orman house down in Elby in 1956. At the bottom is, let's see here. We've got to go back to the top. Hallie Charles Orman, he's leaned up against the one arm up against the post there of the porch, and Arthur, he's leaned up against it. Now below that, sitting down, we've got Arthur Orman and Jenny Mildred Walker Orman, and they're sitting out down there on the front porch, which is low down to the ground, no more reckon than a 4x4 high in width and height. So, okay, excuse me. So we left off our page 71. I'll go back into the second paragraph. Elby and its surrounding areas was settled by strong and sturdy people who came into the area 20, 30, and 40 years before the Civil War. The terrible Civil War ended in 1865, and the people struggled and worked to survive for a number of years without proper shoes and clothing to protect their bodies. They wore no shoes in the summertime and stiff brogans in the winter, if they could afford them. I remember those fine people that inhabited the area. They had love in their hearts, with the Lord as their rule and guide. And while their academic education was very limited, they were highly educated in the ways of life and living in such a country. They had little or no medical assistance. The average lifespan there and then was only about 42 years. Most of the babies were born on the floor of their homes. To get on the floor, they eliminated the danger of rolling off the bed. A lot of the births were carried out by their mothers, doing it alone or with the help of a small child. Remember the mothers of this land? They were there with their pot of beans and some bread, a pat on the back, and their words of encouragement, which carried us through. While they had their ups and downs in everyday life, doing their housework, raising their children, the problems of their communities and life in general, they seldom ever complained. We could probably never have had a church or even won a war without them. We had good solid food such as hog meat, most all kinds of vegetables, fruits in the wilds of the land and the rivers. It was no problem to have a real good fish. It was no problem to have real good fish the year round. We ate squirrels, rabbits, coons, and a variety of other good food. Most of all, the great American people, male and female alike, were raised and came up under this kind of living. Academic learning had a place, but usually came after the obligations of something to eat and a place to sleep. In the immediate area of Elby on the river, the original family was Jim Sterling. He was the father of Will, Albert, Jesse, and John. These people actually cut down the trees and cleared the land and went through untold hardships, a lot of which were sickness due to typhoid fever, malaria, and the agony of childbirth without a doctor. Will Sterling was a cripple as a child, and his folks sold their only team of mules to help him go to school. Albert Sterling was about 18 years of age. When about 18 years of age, moved down the river below Elby and made a little cotton crop, which he cultivated with a milk cow. That's interesting. He drank the milk and used the cow to cultivate the land and managed some way to survive. He was in need of a wife. He was in need of a wife to help carry on the home, and he had a short courtship with Emma, who lived up in the cove above Leslie. That'd be back the other side of the river. Leslie is, used to be river crossing there at LB. I reckon it's still there, but you can't cross it because the people put a driveway or gate up there to where it crosses anyways. But yeah, it used to be a way of going that way. And then down past LB, they've gated it off, plumb down to All Red. And, that's the kind of a sticky sore thing there. But people did it and got away with it. And anyways, there's more of it. The most of it's open. There's the Ozark Grinder Trail that goes through down through there and on down the tracks where they used to run on into Shirley and down and down. It's a long trail. I have a video on YouTube on that, Vincent Easley, on YouTube. Let's see, where'd I leave? I left off, I think it's something to eat and a place to sleep. As I interrupted here, let's go back. In the immediate area of Elby on the river that I already read about there. Let me go start back up here with Albert Sterling. And he was about 18, and he went to Yelp. He was plowing with his cow, and he needed a wife, and so he married and immediately chartered a course of raising two fine girls and one son. Yeah, who'd he marry? Let me back up. To Emma, right? Sorry, I read the whole chapter here. I mean, the whole paragraph. Albert Sterling, when about 18 years of age, moved down the river below Elby, and made a little cotton crop. He cultivated with a milk cow. He drank the milk and used the cow to cultivate the land and managed somehow to survive. He was in need of a wife to help carry on the home, and he had a short courtship with Emma, who lived up in the cove above Leslie. That's where I got lost. They married and immediately charted a course of raising two fine girls and one son. The girls' name were Verva and Verla. Verva died with pneumonia when she was teaching school in Morganton. It's a small community out of B Branch. I know right where it is. I've built fence over there for a dairy farmer, which I reckon he's closed like the rest of them are now here throughout Arkansas. Closed down the dairies, they did. Well, Verla, she died in Elby after being stricken, turning tight. Top of page 72, after being stricken for several weeks with typhoid fever. The water in the town of Elby was bad to the extent that there were several deaths attributed to typhoid fever. Old Sterling, a son of Jesse Sterling, was born and reared in Elby. Owed had a very hard go with a limited education and not very much of anything except the will, desire, and faith to work. Owed went to school to my mother and later became an outstanding railroad man as an official of the Mopac Railroad. Excuse me, that's the Missouri Pacific Railroad in the B&B, which is Bridge and Building Department. He now resides in Shreveport, Louisiana, and is one of the very top officials in the maintenance of way department. He told me the other day when I saw him in Little Rock that he was going to retire in the early part of 1976 and that he was going to go live in Harrison. I can well remember some of the other fine people. For example, Paul Oaf, who was the father of Jacob Shields Oaf, a tremendous fine man. He served as postmaster for a while. Then there were, and there still are, the Goodmans. Most of the descendants of the Goodmans have moved over into Stone County. One of the Goodmans, who I believe was Jess, said that his father and mother moved them into the valley at some point about 6 years south of Elby. The first night they were there, his father, tucked them away in a big hollow sycamore tree that had fallen and was lying on the ground. Boy, ain't that something. There were the Branscombs and the Passmores and the Clarks and the Englands and the Gardners and the Isaacs and the Newlands that lived on the mountain not very far away. I remember Jake Johnson, a merchant at LB, and a very fine person as well as Aunt Lori, his wife, who was a Huey. Huey's still here, so is the Gardners and the Passmores. Where'd I go? A Huey, before she married Jeff Isaacs, and was another merchant at LB, and for a number of years was the postmaster. There was a family that was headed by Jim Wilcox, his wife Nanny. They raised a very fine family. Clarence, one of the children, is a Methodist preacher of the highest caliber. George Barnett and his wife Ida also raised a large family of outstanding character. Ida was the daughter of John Bell Lowrance, who raised a number of fine girls. I cannot, nor could anyone else, include the names of all the fine people who settled this country. Certainly, my failure here to mention their names is for no other reason than lacking the memory, space, and time to enumerate them. Now we find ourselves leading up to the great economic boost of this area, and which was a result of the construction and operation of a railroad. The Missouri and North Arkansas Railway meant meat and bread to a man, woman, and child, as I vividly recall. Right here, I'd like to make a mention of a book that was compiled and written by Mr. James R. Fair, Jr., entitled The North Arkansas Line. I would highly recommend this book to any and all people who have any interest in this area. Mr. Louis A. Watkins, my wife's uncle, who was president of the railroad, told my wife recently that the railroad was actually constructed through Elby in 1906, and that the line between, I'll pause here at page 73 for a bird's eye view of Elby and the Little Red River from Half Moon Mountain. Boy, boy, that's, I can walk straight back to there from here and have fine view. There's a pinery now atop the mountain. Green Bay Packing, unless it was Kraft now. Changed hands, I think. And there's a picture of Arthur Orman fishing at Elby Point on the Little Red River. I believe I see a reel on that pole. Okay. So here we are, picking up on page 74 with and the line between Leslie and Searcy, and was constructed in 1 year. Let me lean back, put my foot up. Here we go. Leslie is mile board 182, and Searcy is mile board 274. Therefore, they actually constructed 92 miles of railroad down through a rough and rugged country in 1 year. Most of all, this work was performed by common labor and mules. Blasting was performed with black powder. The holes were drilled by hand. One man turned a bit, and two men struck the drill bit with hammers. Mr. Watkins says, without any reservation, that Mr. Ferris' book is the most authentic of any book dealing with the history of the Missouri and North Arkansas Railroad. Leslie, 10 miles north of Elby, was a booming, thriving town of approximately 5,000 people. It was a division point on the railroad and had bustling stave mills, one of which was among the largest in the world at that time. I remember when it burned. It was so large that it actually burned for more than a week. During World War I, there was a tremendous inflationary condition. Cotton sold for over $1 a pound. Stave bolts sold from $120 to $150 per cord. Wow, that's a lot of money. And railroad ties sold for over $1 each. During 1918, cotton labor went up to $40 and more per day. Can you imagine what they're having to pay for goods, though? That's a lot of money. That's that was nearly, I reckon, somewhere probably about an ounce or two of gold, which is a lot of money. But I wonder what the inflation of goods were. Let me take a pause here just for a moment. Okay, and we're back. Slight little pause there. Thank you. I left off at, wow, how much this stuff was costing and what they were paying. And when we go into the opposite extreme of it, the union would not accept a reduction in wages and struck in July 1921, shutting the railroad down and paralyzing the entire country. I shall always remember the hardships the railroad union caused up and down the railway. The entire country became devastated by the strike. Many people moved out of the area, but our family and several of the other families stayed on. The union would not work. Neither would they let non-union workers work. The union men would burn bridges, destroy the property and our property and way of life up and down the railway. Was in destroy our way of life and up and down the railway was a deplorable condition. My brother and I graduated. I'm sorry. Let me try again. My brother and I guarded three bridges north of Elby for nearly a year to protect them from destruction. When we got the Arkansas Gazette, it was 5 days old. It traveled from Little Rock to Morrilton in one day, from Morrilton to Clinton in about one day, from Clinton to Shirley in one day, from Shirley to Alburg in one day, and from Alburg to Elby on the fifth day. However, there were a few people who had the money to pay for the Arkansas Gazette. However, there were few people who had the money to pay for the Arkansas Gazette. Finally, the citizens up and down the railroad organized themselves under the Ku Klux Klan and took it upon themselves to literally run the unions and their sympathizers out of the country. In doing so, they used a strap on a number of them, telling them to never let the sun go down on them in this area. One man was hung to the railroad bridge across Crooked Creek below Harrison. Pete Venable, you know what? That was a word I was looking for earlier, and I left one letter out. So that's interesting. Venable. Again, their tunication. Sorry, I've interrupted this reading. Back to Pete Venable, who had been a conductor and who was a strong union man, was called on after the strap and he was told to never return, which he obeyed. There was no in-between ground. You were either a strike breaker or a union man. The strike breakers finally won, and in a short period of time, things became normal, except for the bitterness that prevailed for years to come. The Great Atterbury stood about 6 foot and 6 inches and weighed about 250 pounds. He used a strap and encouraged the union people to leave. He was a leader and was instrumental in helping. We've got to turn pages. We'll come back. I'll stop here at page 75. But this is Haley Charles Orman. It's a picture in the paper here. It says, poor, uneducated, he beat odds to succeed. It comes from Larry Ault at an Arkansas Democrat Gazette. I don't see a date. In Harrison is where the story takes place. And it says, when Haley, Charles Osmond, was 6 years old in 1911, his family packed a boxcar with belongings and rolled a train from Wichita, Kansas to Elby, Arkansas to set up a new home. Orman's grandfather, Arthur Wedmore, had taken a train to Arkansas to check out the area to see if the family could set up two homesteads. Arkansas is where Orman, who died Wednesday of heart failure at age 92, developed a drive to survive and succeed no matter how hard life was, said daughter Mary Jo Grissom of Harrison. When Orman and his family arrived in Arkansas, they unpacked the boxcar, carrying their furniture, fruit jars, the family horse and buggy, the cat. Oh, wait. I think I does say cat, sure enough. The cat and other earthly belongings, and hooked their buggy up to the fine horse for the trip home. But the terrain was so rough, the buggy overturned and broke apart. Orman attended classes in a two-story schoolhouse, also used as a church and Masonic Lodge, where 80 students in grades 1 through 8 got their educations. He recalled that he never felt ashamed of being poor and uneducated. He recalled that he never felt ashamed of being poor and uneducated because so was everyone else in the area at that time. The daily struggle to survive instilled in Orman and his brother, Arthur, the drive to overcome. In the early 1930s, Orman arrived in Harrison by way of the M&NA Railroad. He had begun working for that company at 16 in the LB Depot, where he held all possible jobs, including janitor, dispatcher, and depot agent. Orman survived a train crash and worked through the railroad strike of 1921. Orman's first business break came when he won the bid for a large riprap job near a bridge over the Mississippi River just north of Memphis. Because Orman was underage, his father John, Vivian Orman, had to sign a note so Orman could get a loan to pay enough men to load and fill the rail cars and deliver the rock within the time frame of his bid. In Harrison, Orman worked as a freight rate specialist, but resigned in 1933 to go into business for himself. Orman's net worth at the time was $525 and a Model A Ford. While working for the railroad, he met Janine Mildred Walker. They soon married and charted a business career that, with the help of their secretarial skills, intelligence, and social graces, and his talent for business, engineering, and bookkeeping, made a successful match. Though she soon had the extra duties of raising two girls, Janine Walker Orman, and often spent a large part of her day in the office with her husband. She died in 1978. They began their business with several sawmills surrounding Harrison and the LB area. The business eventually grew to 15 sawmills in 7 counties, employing thousands of people. Orman acquired a sand plant at Everton and created a lumber company known as Willis Orman Lumber at Harrison, and a wood treating plant known as Arkansas at St. Joe. The Arkwood treating plant moved to Omaha, and several post yards were established throughout Arkansas and Oklahoma. Orman was an investor in real estate and theme parks, and dabbled in polities, must be policies or politics, with his friend, the late Governor Orville Faubus. Well, Mr. Orman, now this is a part right there where my friend Kevin had. There's a lot to this story, man, on Orman and these theme parks, and I hope it's going to be revealed in this book. But there was bust and boom throughout, up and down, and so that'll be interesting. I think it has to do with dogwood or something there. Can't quite remember. Let's see, just up. Okay, I got word on from our headmaster here at our school here at RealLibertyMedia.com, RLM Radio, where I'm reading live too. Polity is, and I've got the player in the way, I'm going to have to move you here to see, to read. It is, polity is a noun. It is the form of government of a nation, state, church, or organization. That's kind of, I like that word. It has a lot to do with the idea of self-governance, I think, and being responsible for oneself. And that that goes in there to the Haley Charles Orman, and I am recording, yes, out of Harrison way back when he passed. Now I'm going to back up here where I left off. At the Great Atterbury stood about 6 foot and 6 inches and weighed about 250 pounds. He used the strap and encouraged the union to leave, union people to leave. He was a leader and was instrumental in helping get our country back together after the strike. Now, when you say country, it's going back to this idea here of polity, this local area, the wholeness of it and the people and the matters that come together, I believe. And, I think that's a good way of life. So, I'm sorry, I interrupted again there. To get our country back together after the strike. Atterbury's given name was Marion, like John Wayne. Ha. Huh? He was 10 years older than I. He was born in about 1895. Now, he married A.L. Barnett's daughter at Leslie about 1918, and they had twin boys. They both died within a week of each other's death. Wonder when. After their deaths, Atterbury and his wife divorced to never live together again. Why? I don't know. The railroad decided to resume operations under an open shop plan, non-union. When Arthur and I heard the news, he was 19 and I was 17. We were hoeing potatoes. That was the ninth day of May, 1922. Arthur said, "Do you suppose that we could get to be depot agents? We never had, I think it must be Ben. We had been teaching ourselves, you know, the Morse telegraphic code at home." He says, I replied, "I don't know. Let's go talk to Mama." I shall never forget what she said. "You can always do anything you want to, if you really want to do it." Boy, I'd like to highlight that, but this ain't my book. Page 76. Highlight that in your mind. Let's read it again. "You can always do anything you want to if you really want to do it." We scrapped up 35 cents and went down to Elby and called the general manager at the railroad, who was Mr. J.C. Murray. Arthur did the talking, and his shirt sleeve was trembling. Some way we got the position of agent at Elby. The rate pay was $37.50 a month. So we went to work on strike breakers in May 1922 under an open shop plan after having been shut down since July 1921. The railroad paid Arthur $37.50 per month as agent in Elby, and there were no unions. You were paid for only what you did. The physical property all went up down the railway, suffered something awful. But we read that last week about the damage done, spiking the tanks and all that. Excuse me, on the boilers. The physical property all up and down the railroad suffered something awful, but we still possessed real good personnel. The top executives were J.C. Murray, J.R. Tucker, L.A. Watkins, H.J. Armstrong, J.E. Halter, Frank Cotton, H.P. Mitchell, and Neil Page, and others. About January 1925, W. Stevenson, that'd be ancestor to the author of this here, what I'm a reading, reckon. 1925, W. Stevenson, who had done a successful operation with the JLC&E in northeast Arkansas came to M&A, and he brought with him his key railroad men. They were H.B. Agnew, traffic manager, O.J. Capps, auditor, J.B. Silas, S-I-L-A-Z, general superintendent. Excuse me. Cap Lyons, general roadmaster, and other good railroad men, he says. Under the set... thank you for the notification. Yes, this is Ponder Ganner. It's an Ozark Heritage, Chapter 2, Elba, which is pronounced Elby, then and now. Let's see here. Wills. Over here. Yeah, Cap Lyons and General Roadmaster and other good railroad men. Under this setup, we got new engines, other rolling stock. The tracks was put in its best shape it had ever been in for years. Derailments were stopped and everything was going good. On the local freight south of Leslie to Kensett, there was the great Atterbury, who was the conductor. We read about how big this man was in a strap. We got Fred Melvin. We got Happy Ladd and George Baldwin, who were the brakemen. Bryant was the engineer, but I can't remember the name of the fireman. The M&NA didn't pay me anything until 1924, when I finally received 39 cents per hour as a telegraph operator. I was 19 years old then. This was a fine job, which I was more than proud to possess. Arthur became relief agent in 1924, and when he went on these assignments to possess. Let me try again. Arthur became relief agent in 1924, and when he went out on these assignments to possess, Arthur. That's what I'm doing rereading. When he went out on these assignments, yeah, there should be a comma there. I think I got lost as well. Arthur became relief agent 1924, and when he went out on these assignments, Frank Cotton, who was the chief clerk in this general superintendent's office, would assign Elby to me, which became a telegraph office. Then I was agent operator, earning 39 cents per hour. Dave Gibson was first trick dispatcher. E.F. Stevenson was second trick dispatcher. And E.R. Braswell was third trick dispatcher. And one of the best men I ever knew, he says. I never heard him swear an oath. And he told me, if you don't know what to do, then don't do anything. E.F. Stevenson. Steve was, as we called him, married. Or Steve, as we called him. He married Neil Page's mother. And when I transferred from the operating department to the traffic department, I was working under Neil, who was chief clerk in the traffic department. Mr. H.P. Mitchell was general freight and passenger agent, and Neil was directly under Mr. Mitchell. Neil and I would go down to LB to fish in the Little Red River, but when the fishing was over, it was back to hard railroad work. There were not pets around. You either got the job done or you were out. So the pets meaning nobody got to ride for free. So you either got the job done or you're out. Gone and out of the way. Neil, like myself, came up the hard way, and we didn't expect anything but hard work. We worked lots of nights with no extra pay, as well as Saturdays. We got along together real good. Jeannie Walker, and I think I've been saying her name wrong through there. I think I called her Jeannie a time or two. Jeannie, G-E-A-N-N-E Walker, who I later married, was working in the traffic department when I came to Harrison. She was excellent help and made me a fine wife. When you think about the millions of people in the USA today who receive something for nothing, it's no wonder our debt is approaching $1.5 trillion. No nation in the world has ever survived a situation comparable to this. Arthur moved to Morrilton, Arkansas, and went to work at the railroad there. By the time I was 25, I became an official of the railroad in the freight traffic department. Mr. H.B. Agnew was general traffic manager of the railway, and he helped me in many ways. My last 5 years were in the traffic department. I worked most all the time, and I was one of the best in rates and divisions, which was a specialty. When Mr. Andrew left the MNA, he went to Hammond, Louisiana. Hi, I was down there. Where he worked for a small railroad. He wanted me to go with him, but because Jeannie and my folks, I decided to stay here. I've often wondered what the outcome would have been had I gone with Mr. Agnew. I would have probably made a great success railroading. In the spring of 1927, the big flood hit us. We nearly lost... In the spring of 1927, the big flood hit us, and we nearly lost the White River Bridge at milepost 293. I'm trying to think where that is. I'm thinking, well, no, that's Lost Creek, where that bridge has gone out, down there by Lightless. I'm not sure where that would be. There's probably a lot that I don't know. Well, I know there is. let's see, back they about lost the White River Bridge at milepost 293, and the railway was severely damaged south of Leslie. On top of this, we got hit with the Great Depression, and our business dropped off over 50%. This carried on from October 24, 1929, until the summer of 1932. During the Great Depression, which came with the stock market crash October 24, 1929, our paychecks on the railroad got 5 months behind. The railroad simply could not pay its operating expenses because of the terrible depression. Mr. Stevenson and his railroad men, including me, left the MNA. In the summer of 1932, I had been agent at virtually every railroad station on the line. I worked 116 months. That was 4 months short of the time required for a railroad pension. When I resigned, I went into business for myself. My net worth at that time consisted of $525 and a Model A Ford car. I feel quite sure that God in heaven certainly helped us all. My father was always in debt. The money Arthur earned working for the railroad was used for something to eat and to pay the interest on what Papa owed. The debt situation hung over our heads until the fall of 1932, when I did some government stone contracts and paid all of those old debts off, which was around, good night, $10,000. That was a big thing to do during the depression of 1932. Grimner says, oh, he's being funny about our village expert in the chat channel at Real Liberty Media. That was funny and distracting. $10,000, my word. And I just swore, reckon. That's a lot of money. Wow. Quite a feat. Well, let me continue. As time rolled on, the unions got in control again and were the cause why the operation, I'm trying to turn the page, why the operation shut down in 1947 to never operate as a whole unit anymore. The unions all over the USA today are causing higher production costs on the goods we produce to the extent that we no longer compete in the world markets as we were able to do so for many years before the unions so dramatically raised our cost to produce. I back up and pause here for a moment on page 78. We've got a picture of Jeannie Walker Orman and Haley Charles Orman right there. Reckon when that would have been sometime. And we've got Mary Jo Orman at 5 years old and Ina Ann Orman at 4 years old. They're the daughters of Jeannie and Hallie C. Orman. That looks like 70s to me, both those pictures. Let me give a pause just for a moment here. Okay, left off there at the top of page 79. Second paragraph, after how the union had dramatically raised the cost to produce. The engines that pulled the trains up and down the Little Red River for some 40 years shall always be dear to my heart. I can hear their whistles blowing, and I remember those fine train and engine men who are so dependable. I have no regrets. One should not look back. Look forward. Work hard with love in your heart, and everything will work out okay. There are 1,000 times enough destructive weapons available to destroy the world. So what? If we sit down and spend our time worrying about this, then that's what would get us. If George Washington decided to stay at home, he would not have had such a nice trip, and the Indians would have had a quiet and pleasant life. So what? Had old Spot been raised by someone else rather than me, he might have been a bear dog. So what? Under our way of life, we choose our own destiny. As to religion, the way or manner, if any, we serve our Lord and Master. Thereby we are the responsible person. God, can you hear these words? These are the words that have the meaning right here. We have the God-given right to lie down or stand up to say our prayers. The manner in which we pray for self or others, or for others, is left for us to decide. May we pray for a better understanding about the things we should know more about. Man, those are incredible words. Wow. Arthur Orman, my brother Arthur Orman, was born in Carlsbad, New Mexico, August 1903, and furnishes the following information. John Vivian Orman and Mary Ann Orman, with their two sons, Arthur and Hallie, moved to the area in 1911 with Mrs. Orman's father, Arthur Wedmore. They homesteaded lands at Shane, 3 miles west of Elby. I don't know where that is. I don't know about where it'd be, but I don't recall. I don't know. Been up river then. Let's see. All right, I've interrupted myself. They homesteaded lands at Shane, 3 miles west of Elby, and another homestead 1 mile west. My father, J.V. Orman, was a commercial beekeeper with apiaries at Marshall, Cove, Leslie, and Elby, where he had around 300 colonies of bees. He was the first beekeeper in the state of Arkansas to ship carlot bee supplies into the state and to ship live bees out of the state. He organized the first Arkansas State Beekeepers Association and was instrumental in creating the Arkansas State Apiary Board and its first chief inspector with an office in the state capitol in Little Rock. The principal industry in Elby area was the production of railroad cross ties and white oak stave bolts used in the production of stave barrels from the virgin red and white oak, and was abundant in the area and along the railroad. Peaches were commercially produced and shipped in carload lots. Elby was a thriving little community with a census of approximately 200 people, which was at its height during the World War I around 1918. The town had a nice one-room schoolhouse teaching grades from 1 through 8 at an average daily attendance of about 80, with only one teacher. Some of the teachers in the past were Grady Watkins, Harrison Allred, Allred's down the river, H.W. Branscombe, and Mrs. J.V. Orman. Many of the students walked 2 miles to school and carried their lunch. Stopping at the top of page 80, we've got the big house at Elby in 2004. And This old school bell was relocated out front. And 1904, we've got yet still strong and relaxing. Look at that. That's a nice picture of the big house. Let's turn on to page 81. Up here at the top. The town had a Masonic lodge, blacksmith shop, a grist mill, barber shop, eat shop where you get some soda pop, milkshakes, bananas, candy, and a lunch. It had a two-story frame country hotel where you could get three square meals a day. There were six general stores in LB owned by the following: J.N. Jeff Isaacs, whose daughter Olivia Isaacs now lives in Denard, Arkansas. We got Joe Tipton, J.V. Orman and Sons, a National Tie and Timber Company operated by H.B. McGee, and later by J.S. Oaf, whose wife Etta Oaf now lives at Shirley, Arkansas. Bill Oaf lives over down the creek, Petey Creek, about slipped out, and his brother does the chuck wagon races here in Clinton every year, and him and his wife, the Oafs there at Bar Oaf Ranch, Clinton, Arkansas, Labor Day weekend every year. All right, where'd I leave off with Miss Etta Oaf that now lives in Shirley? W.T. Sterling, who later sold to Jake Johnson, and Mr. and Mrs. Jess Sterling. They were also a nice railroad station and a freight department. Oh, there was also a nice railroad station and freight department. The following people served as postmasters at Elbin: J.N., Jeff Isaacs, and Marianne Orman. Even though the active life of Elby was tied directly to the same demise as the Missouri and North Arkansas Railroad, the area is rich in tradition and warm memories to very many people. The valley proved to be the forge for very many successful men and women, injecting into their very souls the pioneer spirit that made this country what it is today. Haley D. Grissom. There came a scout by the name of John Wedmore from Parker County, Texas. That's where my son was born. I lived in Parker County. It's where the Goodnight Lovin' Trail goes through. Ain't it funny how lives and history weave together? Well, there came a scout. Let's go back. There came a scout by the name of John Wedmore from Parker County, Texas, traveling on the M&NA Railroad from Wichita, Kansas. Like many of the day, he was searching for a place to homestead that would provide life and prosperity for his family. He and John Vivian Orman, his son-in-law, his daughter, Mary, and their two sons, Haley Charles and Arthur Vivian, chisels out two neighboring homesteads on Stiles Mountain just west of the Valley of Elby. Mary Wedmore had just obtained an education from the Texas College for Women in Denton, Texas, where she met J.V. about 1890. J.V. was a quiet and gentle man and a naturalist, a cattle driver and a beekeeper. He raised bees and peaches in the harsh virgin lands around Elby and shipped queen bees, live beehives, and honey by boxcar load on the M&NA Railroad. Mary and J.V.'s two sons were strong boys and eyed the thriving Elby community below their homestead with great ambition. Haley and Arthur only received an eighth grade education, mostly from their school teacher mother. What they lacked in book knowledge was far surpassed by their desire to succeed. Haley once told Arthur, "I will one day own Elby and all her surrounding land." It became so through wretching hard work, such as stowing ties, selling rip-rap to the M&NA, soon serving as telegrapher, depot agent, and eventually freight rate specialist in Harrison, Arkansas. Haley became one of the first paid freight coordinators on the line. Earlier in their careers as teenagers, Haley and Arthur would plan such money-making schemes as the Elba Picnic, a day of food, gambling, drinking, and probably other things neither my mother or grandmother has shared with me. Haley met my grandmother, Jeannie Mildred Walker, in Harrison. She, too, worked for the MNNA freight office. They were an educated match. He's strong and driven, and she graceful, smart, and full of class. With his temperament and her sense of humor, a deeply dedicated and successful bond was formed. A home was kept in Harrison, so their two girls, Mary Jo and Tiance, she's called, could attend school. However, weekends, holidays, and summers were about Elby. Work and exploring the Little Red River Valley until the girls became older with social distractions in Harrison. We'll back up here. Page 82. Attractively furnished and decorated in the style of the period, Elby Hotel comfortably sleeps 22 persons in 10 bedrooms. And here's a picture of a bedroom here, bedsteads and a quilt over it. And a nightstand with the lamps on either side, and a picture hanging overhead, and a big fluffy pillow, and a dress hung in the corner with a hat, a bonnet hung at the end of the bedpost. We got large living rooms await the friendly conversion of new and returning visitors. Very plush. Looks to be a, what is that? Does it? Looks like a TV is sitting on top of old pedaled, surely it ain't, pedaled sewing machine in front of a fireplace. Huh. And then we've got a well-appointed kitchen with the look of yesteryear, but with all the modern conveniences, ready for preparing, satisfying country meals. Reckon that's in the old big house, Funder? No, the hotel. Okay, well, looks like you could get in there and cook up anything you're ready to. Well, here we come to page 83 in Elby Today. And this comes from Haley Grissom. And the phone number at this time was 870-741-0354. Call for information and rates for small or large group gatherings. I'm not sure what year it was there then, but they're not having it going right now. But I reckon... somebody to still answer that phone number. That's 870 area code. I'm in 501. 870 kicks in just above me. Hiawassee, Arkansas used to be 501. They split Arkansas up. There's 870 and 479 up there in Benton County now. I believe that is. Excuse me. All right, let me pick back up here at Elby Today. Nestled gently and quietly at the base of Half Moon and Stiles Mountain, skirted by the banks of the Middle Fork of the Little Red River, Elby remains a piece of Americana and preservation. The small yet bustling town was established, like most in the day, with the growth of the Missouri and North Arkansas rail line. At its peak, the Whistle Stop was home to 80 families with such ordinary services as a post office, general store, barber shop, Elby School, Church, Masonic Lodge, all in one, and a boarding house now fondly chronicled the Armand House. We, the descendants of these proud and worthy folk, my mother, Mary Jo Armand Grissom, her sister, Ina Ann Tience, and my brother Kurt, are pleased and complimented to share with you our pristine valley and its 100-year-old structures. The descendants of the Arthur Ormond branch of the family are equally proud and visit Elby often. Elby is truly a living history, and we welcome any facts or tales that you may have heard about Elby. If you know someone who has heritage in the town of Elby, please send them our way. We gladly offer a tour of the Little Red River Valley, the Ormond home, and the Emmett and Marie cabin, and the Jess Isaacs house in exchange for those dear old stories. Our restoration continues, still to be preserved, includes the old Elby School, Masonic Lodge, the post office, barber shop, and general store, and other old structures. Recently, an attempt was made to burn the schoolhouse, but damage was limited to the front door and some flooring. That this attempt to burn the community center failed is a miracle. Therefore, in hope that there will be no further assaults against the LB, every attempt will be made to locate and prosecute the person or persons who attempted to burn the LB schoolhouse. At the bottom is a picture of the Armin family gathering. Left to right, Ina Ann Tience Orman, Charles Lewis Orman, son of author Kurt, Hallie D., Mary Jo, and Bud Grissom. I'm betting that's 1970-something, reckon. Might be just a little later. Trying to determine by the clothes there. Finally dressed, so it's a little hard to determine for sure. Now we get over to page top of 84. We've got the old LB Schoolhouse and Masonic Lodge building today. Still standing tall and stately under the oak trees and structured very sound. I'm looking at the picture. The capstone is at the back left over there. So I've been in there and upstairs. Lots of relic steel. I ain't sure how it's been 15 years ago probably when I was in there. Oh, we've got Ray, Unknown, and Doyle, LB School. Howdy, boys. They looking like they belong. All right, here we go. I think I'm down to 10 pages. What am I telling? An hour and 20 minutes in. Chapter 3 is 10 pages away. Less than 10. There's a blank page. 93. 8 pages. I think I can do this. Any more pictures? No more pictures? Yeah, let's read it out. Hold on a minute. Okay. Let's see. Here we are. Page 85 at the top. And we got Ola Lowrance McFarland, as emailed by her daughter, Leola. Mom says the next place up the road from the Lowrance place headed toward Half Moon away was away from LB was one. Let me try again. Mom says that the next place up the road from the Lowrance place headed toward Half Moon away from LB was once called the Briggs place. After the Briggs, who she does not remember, the Honeycutts lived there. The father was Phil Honeycutt, and before the molasses makers came to the Lowrance's place to make molasses, they set up their tents and so forth at the Honeycutt place. To clarify, they did not set up in both places, but once had set up only at the Honeycutt's and later set up at the Lowrance place. The Honeycutts moved away, but not totally out of the area. They were still prominent in the community, and then the Hobbs family moved into the Honeycutt place. So one place, three families, the Hobbs that moved in were Frank Hobbs. Parents, Frank Hobbs married Harriet Victoria Lowrance, or at least his father and new wife, I'm not sure. Anyway, Briggs, Honeycutt, Hobbs, one place. Now, if I have anything close to correct, Frank and Vic lived where they were first married in a log cabin below the Lowrance place, but not the log cabin where Mom and Maddie were born. This log cabin is where they lived when Ruby was born. Then Frank and Vic moved what Mom now calls the sample place, which is where Mildred was born. Before the samples lived in the sample place, there was a test tomorrow, ho-ho, in parentheses, the Freds lived there. The samples were only there a short time. They came from the city, Kansas City, I believe, and they had no clue on how to farm and survive, so they were not there too long. Here we have Ford, Samples, Hobbs, Frank, and Vic. This place was just above Elby. Now, coming from Half Moon, there was a fork in the road. Going left, you passed the Briggs Honeycutt place, Briggs Honeycutt Hobbs place, Frank Hobbs' parents, and so forth. Then to the Lowrance homestead. Beyond the Lowrance homestead was a family named Usury. Never heard that one before. If you went right at the fork, you passed the Ford sample Frank and Vic Hobbs place. Are you confused? Which was atop the hills above Elby. And towards Allburg, where the McKinney, then Barnett place, and I have not yet figured out where that road was. I know where it is, and it's pretty much obscure now. Anyway, so if you're coming up out of down to Elby down there, there's the road come up Half Moon up to the top, the back of the mountain, but it's not so much accessible now, grown over and everything else. And I'm pretty sure I know where you're talking about. I am sure I have perfect. Thank you, Miss Ola. I'm sure I've confused you mightily, because I'm totally confused. Mom says there were no dead ends, and maybe there weren't at the time. At one point, she stuck to her guns when I questioned her several times. She told me you could take either the left fork or the right fork to reach Hobbs place. So maybe the road looped around somehow. I'm sorry for all this confused information. I went over it and over it with her, and we laughed. Yeah, and said it must be one of those places where you can't get there from here. At the very least, we've cleared some things up with the information that several of the families in the history lived at different times at the same homestead. Mom has never been great on giving directions, so I know this information is not totally accurate, and I have not probably even presented it in a clear manner. I'm sending it on to you as best I can, and hope something here will mesh with others' information. You have received, so you will be able to fit it all together and make sense. I really can't make it all come together to my satisfaction. Well, thank you, Miss Ola. Okay, we're coming on over here to 86 at the top, remembering childhood days in Elby, from Doyle Barnett, April 17, 1995, in the childhood years at Elby in 1970 to 1979. It is so pleasant to remember our childhood and youth days in Elby. Good old days they were. In imagination, we go back to the early 1900s. There was Clinton and Leslie, all the surrounding communities of Allburg, Shirley, Horseshoe Bend, Half Moon, Denard, Plant, Lexington, Rumley, and so forth. Places of our childhood memories, especially from some of us old-timers. We didn't have much in those days and lived very simply. Maybe similar to how some primitive tribes in New Guinea live today. Compared with today's society, we had nothing of this world's goods. Yet I think we had more wholesome fun and enjoyed a richer life than today's children who have so much. Our little home was so plain, it was hard to imagine anything much more pure and simple. Two small crowded rooms and a heating stove and Dad and Mom's bed in it. A kitchen with a cook stove, a firewood box behind. An old chest for dishes and a dining table crowded in. Then, three beds for us children in the attic. And food? Milk, just as it came from the cow. Cornbread soaked in the milk. Molasses made from our own sugar cane. Fresh eggs from our chickens. Beans and taters. Greens and onions from our garden were all part of our regular diet. Mama served fresh homemade biscuits. Flour, soda, and salt, with butter and molasses every morning, along with fried or boiled eggs. And sometimes meat and fresh vegetables. We had two or three cows and a few chickens. If we lived like that today, our food bill would probably be over $50 a month. It feels so different to live that simply in today's society, and we'd be healthier for it. Dad purchased a farm across the Little Red River from our home a quarter mile away, and then secured a small rowboat for crossing, especially when the river was flooded. He also used it for catching fish at night. This was done by using a pressure kerosene lantern that blinded the fish. One person would row the boat while the other held the gig and watched for fish. There were times when my brother, Irvy, spent a whole night gigging fish. The M and NA Railroad that passed through Elby wound around through the hills, following the path of the Little Red River. There was a daily morning train going west and an evening one traveling east. Usually the highlight of the day's activities for many of Elby's residents was to meet the trains both in the morning and afternoon and see the people coming and going. We younger ones were always fascinated, too, with this big steam engine, the blowing of its whistle, and the powerful metal wheels that pulled the train. And the station manager provided good entertainment. When the train left, he often stood on the steps of one of the passenger cars and talked with the conductor as the train chugged away. Then as he jumped from the speeding vehicle, he hit the ground running with the train until he could stop. There was at least one time when he fell and injured himself. Thereafter, he was always more careful to jump before the train had gained too high of a speed. As we children were growing up, we were isolated from the rest of the world. There was no highway, not even a county road, but just a narrow passageway like a farm road through a field that was beaten down by horses and wagons. Very seldom did anyone except those who worked required it leave Elba except to explore a little further beyond the treetops of the horizon. The closest towns were only 20 miles away, but they seemed to us like 1,000 miles. It was usually only railroad working people who ever had a chance or money to do any traveling, but Dad was one of them. He was a tie loader. His job required traveling by passenger or freight trains or other towns like Leslie, Gilbert, Marshall, or Aalborg. Timber-covered hills and valleys surrounded those communities. The timber had to be large enough to make railroad ties, at least 6 inches by 8 inches and 6 to 10 foot long. That's after you cut them. Cut to that size. They had to be a quality of timber available in the forest and enough to supply the needs for the railroad tie company. In the early days when the railroad was first built, the hills and valleys were covered with beautiful trees, mostly pines and oak trees with several other varieties scattered among them. But with the demand of the tie companies, the hills were quickly denuded of their beautiful robes. Oh, I've seen pictures. Massive canopy oak trees. The ties were made with simple hand tools by strong, hard-working men. The only saw available was a cross-cut saw. You know what? I hauled some fatwood. Probably I'm going to expect at least 50 years old, but there was the notch was hewn by axe, and the cross-cut, well, the falling cut was obviously had been with a cross-cut tie. I can't remember what I did with it. I think I preserved that and give it to somebody, though. I can't remember. But anyways, very old history there. I found out there working Herbie Prout's back off of 110. Now, where'd I interrupt myself? Let me see here. Must have been up here. And I'll start the second chapter, paragraph. It was usually only railroad workers working whoever had a chance to spend the money. Yeah. You know how large they were. In the early days, when the railroad was first built, they were covered, you know, and they were denuded of their beautiful robes. Ties were made with simple hand tools by strong, hard-working men. The only saw available was a cross-cut saw that had a handle on each end and was 5 or 6 foot long. Either felling trees or cutting them in sections, there had to be one man on either end of the saw, pulling back and forth in seesaw action. Then it took... Hold on. Oops. Come back here. Okay. Where'd I leave? Okay, sorry. Here it is. Then it took a skilled, strong, hardy man about 3 hours of hewing with a broad axe to square the tie evenly on 4 sides. I wonder if they rip cut them too? Must have. Big trees, you're not going to hew one big huge tree down like the cartoon, which is that they took a whole tree and make a toothpick. Obviously not. All right, so then of course there had had to be some way to transport the ties, first by wagons to the railroad yards, then by railroad cars to wherever it was needed. A tie loader had to be strong enough to carry a tie on his shoulder from the tie yard and up a ramp to a box car or flat car. Usually several men worked together helping each other in getting the tie placed on the carrier's shoulder. The long switch ties required two men with good coordination and balance. The company's the company agent, H.B. McGee, was always present. He usually had six or eight men in the tie loading crew. In those days, tie making, hauling, and loading, along with other types of railroad work, was about the only employment available for earning cash in the little towns along the railroad. rail walking was a great pastime activity for us children. We competed to see who could stay on the rail on the longest without falling off. Crossing the railroad bridges was the most dangerous part. Mama was always scared that we would not make it across before the train appeared. Little daredevils we were, never visualizing the danger. We would hang precariously over the railroad bridges and letting our three-pronged fishing hooks. Okay. We squinted, and you know, I was always warned as a kid about sitting on the bridge and make your head swim watching the water down there, and you'd fall off. Yeah, I can imagine stories here. Sure enough. So the little daredevils we were, we had never visualizing the danger. We would hang precariously over the railroad bridges and let down our three-pronged fishing hooks. We squinted and searched the creek for catfish lying on the bottom. Then we would very carefully and slowly maneuver our hooks close to their heads, hoping they would not dart away before you jerked the line. Where we occasionally hooked one, we were highly elated. We had fun roaming and romping over the hills. It was thrilling to search out the wild goat trails. Ray will remember the time or two. Remember the time the two of us chased the goats around the narrow ledges between the upper and lower bluffs. You ought to see this country out here. You cannot appreciate, I don't think, just by my description. I got a few pictures. I'll need to take some more down to the LV, though. Where was I running around them hills and chasing goats with them? I was in my mind. Well, let's see here. Between the upper and lower bluffs were the sheer walls above and sheer drop-off below. Before the pursuit was over, we learned in one quick lesson that we were certainly not as agile and sure-footed as they. The goats disappeared so quickly, we wondered if they had fallen over the ledges. We were afraid of doing. We never took the risky hazards like that again, nor did we tell anyone what we did, not even Dad and Mom. If our parents had known of our pursuing the goats over those narrow ledges, we would have scared them to death. I'm not sure that our guardian angels... says, no, I am sure that our guardian angels must have protected us from many hidden dangers on those narrow, slippery passages. Well, ain't that the truth? I'm going to have to pause again. Let me take a little break. Okay, I'm back to the record here at the pretty near to the top of page 88. I guess I am. Swimming in a little red river after the chasing them goats stimulated our love for water. We never wearied in wading the mountain streams or tired of climbing cliffs and bluffs. We always liked to follow Irvy on the explorations and trapping routes because he knew what he was doing and did not attempt the impossible. Rabbit chasing was always exciting, and hunting skunk, possum, and possums kept us in suspense. Irvy was our family's wild animal trapper. He knew how clever the raccoon was in outwitting his trapping schemes. They seemed to always know what to do to avoid getting caught in concealed traps. As children, we were amazed at their animal intelligence. They could steal the bait and yet avoid getting caught. They would have laughed at our trapping skills, but it was a matter of life and death for them, while only fun to us. Looking back, it seems that they were quite cruel and heartless. One time a coon gnawed his leg off in order to escape from the trap. Others would be injured in desperate attempts to get loose from the steel traps. I can see the groundhog being flushed out of their holes. They made their dens just above the river bank of Dad's farm, but we didn't bother them until they made havoc with our cornfield. They were hardy animals and not easy to catch. We finally resorted to pouring barrels of water into their holes to force them to come out. When they stuck their heads out, Ring, our faithful dog, was there awaiting them, and what a fight ensued. Even though they were small compared with Ring, yet it seemed as though they'd kill him in their life and death struggle. Many times we surprised water moccasins, also called cottonmouth, off their smug and sunny resting places. They were found on the banks of the streams or on a log, bush, or whatever, and they positioned so they could escape and slither underwater even before we saw them. We must not have realized how poisonous they were, or we'd have been more careful. It's a miracle that none of us ever got bitten, for time after time we were exposed to their poisonous fangs. We were so bold in approaching them, I'm sure our guardian angels must have protected us, for it seemed at times we would see dozens of them along the streams. Then there were the squirrels that stripped the edges of our cornfields. Irvy was a sharpshooter in our family, and after his keen eyes ferreted out their concealed hiding place in the tallest trees, his steady .22 rifle aim usually dropped a squirrel dead to the ground. In those days, squirrels was a delicacy in the Barnett home. A second-hand corn feed was the squirrel had been living on. Huh. I remember how the little Red River water was, even in summertime. But we could care less. In freezing weather, we dared each other to jump in. One of us usually accepted the dare, and then we swam, bathed, and had lots of fun. The frigid water only stimulated our circulation and speeded up our movements, which kept us warm. And running barefooted in the snow was hilarious, too. Dad had quite an ability in felling trees. He could figure out just which way they should fall, and then make them fall in that direction. But the hard work really began when we started trimming off the limbs and sawing the trunk into short blocks for firewood with a two-man crosscut saw. It seemed that it took forever to saw just one huge firewood-sized block. Wow, that was really work, but we were happy to have the wood to keep us warm in freezing weather. I'm going to tell you, there's an old saying about firewood, it warms you twice. Well, in the burning, of course, and in the fetching and the making of it. My understanding is, back in the days, you had a time. There was time in August between the planting and the harvesting and all that, that the firewood, when you went to go making firewood. I've got a gnat buzzing me, and I'm going to catch him if I can. But so August, the hottest part of the year, is when you generally was making firewood. That's to my understanding. Now, where? I've gone on. Yes, to top of page 89, where we would search the hillsides for pitch knots, I call them pine knots, from rotted pine trees. It's also called fatwood and pitch and a few other names, depending on where locally you're at there. So pine knot, called here. They really made great kindling wood. We're especially happy for pitch splinters when Dad called us. When Dad called us on early cold mornings to start a fire in the heating stove, the pitch splinters burned easily for, it's spelled E-A-S-I-O-Y, poke at my name, fun, burned easily for starting a quick burning fire. Boy, I've almost run to my reading voice out here. But I think I can finish. It's only a couple more pages here. All right, let's read it through. Let's try. All right. Elby was a small town of around 15 families, besides other families scattered in the surrounding hills as well as up and down the river, who all patronized Elby's small businesses. There were two dry goods stores, which also sold some food products. They carried an assortment of goods, such as simple living country people could use. One was operated by an older couple who were very kind and lovely people, Mr. and Mrs. Johnson. The other one was run by Mr. and Mrs. Shields Oaf, who were about our parents' age. Mrs. Oaf's shop had a covered porch at the front entrance with fixed benches, providing a place for us keeping up with news about the comings and goings from the town's populace. So there was often a small group who sat there for hours, each adding his juicy morsels by pulling two and two together and making it eight. Now, I'm telling this story here, and I remember as a little boy up in Hiawassee, Arkansas, up there in front of Pooch General Store there, and the same, very same scene. So I vision it in my mind this 50-odd year ago, I reckon, 50 year. Yeah, back. Man, it seems like a long time, and it don't seem so long at all. Sitting here where I'm at, fixing to turn 55 in 2 weeks. Yep. I remember as a little boy. Almost 50 years sometimes, and sometimes over 50 years, I remember, I reckon. Well, they carried on. They carried an assortment of goods. Yeah, I've read that. I've lost myself here. The juicy morsels by putting two and two together and making eight. I love that. That's perfect. They'd whittle away on pieces of wood while passing their time away, sharing idle tales. Often, when they got tired of whittling, they'd get kids into a fight or a scuffling match. I remember some of the scuffles that took place with the Cooley boys. Cooleys are still here, and the Oafs that moved off from around here, but they're in the local community of Van Buren County. Gus Cooley was about my age and size and was a good fist fighter. But I was never eager for a boxing match for fear he would hurt me, but was willing to wrestle with him. I think he always got the best of me anyhow. What fun it was to take a sack of shelled corn to that old grinding mill behind Oaf's store and get it transformed into cornmeal. We used to stand and watch the old one-cylinder mill for hours at a time. It was the first motorized equipment we'd ever seen. Its single firing and explosion sound, and then 1 minute waiting time. Then about 1 minute waiting time for while it seemed to breathe and heave, fascinated us to no end. Then there was a long belt and large flywheel, which was an amazing machine. The miller was a kind old man and took his pay in kind, a part of the grain, half, as I recall, instead of cash, which is a rare commodity in our home, and what a terrific cornbread Mama Ivy Lee and Dora made out of that meal. Great memories. What would we have done without cornbread and hot biscuits? Irvy, Dora, and Ray will remember Elmer Cooley's animal stories. Like Ed, Ivy's husband and his, Henry, he had a great imagination and made his stories come alive. They were extremely interesting, a very good entertainer and storyteller, as I recall. Some people have that special talent. His stories were always scary, but very attention-getting. In each story, he was a hero, keeping us sitting up on the edge of our chair, waiting for the next unknown thrill. Just wish I had some of his storytelling ability. Me too. Then there was Mama's Cliffhangers. The stage performance. It was a dark night, and Elmer had been telling some hair-raising ghost stories. After a few thrillers, he and Irvy went out to the barn on some errand. Their exit into the dark night gave Mama an idea. Quickly, she took from her closet a large white sheet and slipped into the darkness of the night and found a hiding place behind the smokehouse and waited for the brave youth to pass by. Then, closed in her white sheet, and like a flash, she jumped from behind the same time, let out a loud, blood-curdling screech. I'll scream. Talk about green lightning. Elmer and Irby had it that night. Irby was, he was naturally turning the page here. Come on, around here. Yeah, all right. He was naturally a fast runner, but Elmer played first fiddle and volunteered to run ahead. All Irby had to do was follow Elmer's streak of light. Maybe he was holding on to Elmer's coattail for both of them crashing into the back door at the same time. They thought for sure the Panthers were ready to devour them. And sure enough, just seconds later, a huge mama panther roared in and pounced right in on them. Sounds like my mom. Oh, that'll bring tears to your eyes in memory. Yeah. Unable to contain herself, she split her sides laughing. Neither before nor after thereafter did we ever see Mama tied up in such anguished knots of laughter as she was that night. She, like Maddie, her young sister, was always a person who liked to have fun. Elmer's hell-raising stories, along with Mama's participation, must have been the most hilarious experience of our childhood days. According to my memory, that was the greatest laughter party of our childhood times. Nothing excelled it. It might have lasted 30 minutes. We always enjoyed hearing Elmer's tales, but that night was special. His extreme fright, instead of his self-proclaimed bravery, became our fun. Thinking back on it, I wonder if our laughter hurt his feelings, for I don't remember much of his storytelling after that night. Could have you gotten his wit scared out of him, or did he tame down his stories just so he left impression, so he left less impression in our memories? Well, we'd have much fun exploring the cliffs on the hills below Grandpa Lawrence's place and the Horseshoe Bend, and also up a hollow from Elby on the way to Half Moon. Looking through our childhood eyes, those hills appeared huge, and their precipitous walls of rock were fantastic. We never tired of their beauty, nor the fragrance of the pine trees. And there was always something new to challenge our inquiring minds. We explored nooks and crooks and followed the trails around the crevices and ledges. The streams and hills were most alluring, and in our minds, they were unexcelled. There were days when we did not have much fun. One day, Dad took us across the river to a large field, which was completely covered with huge, dried, hard clots of dirt. He assigned us the job of breaking them up with hammers and axes. This was one time when our fun disappeared. So far as we were concerned, it was the most distasteful and terrible task we'd ever been assigned. We tried to convince Dad that there was a better way, but he wasn't in a reasoning mood that day. Taking his big hammer, he broke up a few clods to show us how easy it was. But he had trouble in getting our interest. I don't recall at all whether we ever got the job done, yet we pounded at it, and after it rained, Dad planted the field in corn, and it was a terrible, painful task. One day, we three boys were walking by the spring on the other side of the river. Big Brother Irby was walking ahead when suddenly it seemed like all hell broke loose. We all froze in our tracks, paralyzed with fear. Our ears were filled with what sounded like 100 rattlesnakes attacking us at the same time. Somehow Irby broke loose from his frozen position and became the hero that saved us from sure death. Dad's farm produced plenty of stone, and Irby knew how to use rocks. Those rattlers lost the battle and found themselves covered with a pile of rock. We could eventually believe our eyes when Irby pulled out only 1 6-foot rattlesnake under that rock pile. We're still wondering how just one rattle how one rattler made all that loud frightening sound. This second. Okay, sorry about that little pause in there. I'm sure I'm going to have to find my place again. Yeah, I've lost myself in here somewhere, looking for the snakes. Well. I had to pause there and I lost my place. There it is, down at the bottom. daily it seemed we scampered down to the railroad station and to enjoy the excitement of the comings and goings and the mornings and afternoon passenger trains. That was fun too. Also, we were fascinated with the Orman family's many beehives behind the railway station. But much woe was in store to the boy who messed around and irritated him. I can tell you from personal experience that it's no fun to face a hive of angry bees. One day, my naive curiosity just had to be satisfied. So I said to Ray, "You climb over the fence and I'm going to test the bees by pushing a long stick into their hive." That's one time he obeyed his older brother and showed he had better sense than his experienced big brother. Then I stuck the stick into the opening of the beehive. I don't remember what happened next, but when I regained consciousness, I was in Johnson's store and a group of people surrounded me. 1,000 bees attacked me at the same time and deposited their poisonous stingers in my hair, head, hands, and feet. No one ever tried to count them, but they had a good picking session and kept whispering to one another whether or not I'd die. I learned a lesson that day that has served me well all through my life. I can still see old Ring swimming in the river. All Dad or Irvy had to say was, "Ring, go get the cows." And he'd obey instant. He'd cross the river, listen for their bells, bound through the woods and fields and drive them home. He did it every day, that is, until something terrible happened. On this occasion, he did as he was told, but unknown to Ring, an enemy, the husk, the humankind, was waiting in ambush for him. Well, when we saw Ring again, he had no cows in front of him. He was beaten up. He could hardly walk, and it took weeks for healing and his strength to return. But even though he did recover, he would never again go alone after the cows. Dad and Mama had found out who did it, and doubtly it was good they... oh, I'm sorry. Dad and Mom never found out who did it, and doubtless it was good they didn't. In addition to their dog Ring, they had 3 boys to train and needed jobs for them to do. Could have been a blessing in disguise. I'll never forget Harrison Allred and Nellie Newport, our school teachers. Teacher Allred was a red-headed widower, about 25 or 30 years old, and had a bad reputation in my childhood mind. If anyone in our home even mentioned his name, it frightened me. My 2 older sisters and brothers, cued our parents in on his conduct after school each day. And naturally, Dad and Mom were eager to learn from them all about our school principal's shenanigans. And after each day, sought to draw out from them what they could. I was only 5 or 6 years old, and their report scared the wits out of me. I knew the time would come when I'd also be a student and become one of his victims. I visualized doing some behavior that would give him ground for punishing me before the whole class. He might grab me by the hair of my head, shake me back and forth, then lift me up to the platform to embarrass and make a public display of me. Just the thought of attending school terrified me. I remember being frightfully timid. When visitors, especially strangers, came to our home, I'd crawl under the bed to hide. I'd stay there until they left. Dad and Mom knew nothing about the horror and terror I had for school. At least I never told them. Neither did they understand my abnormal timidity and fears. Finally, the day came when I was old enough to be sent to school with Ivy Lee and Irving and Dora. What a fearful ordeal it was. At first, Mom and Dad told me to go along with my sisters and brother. I refused to cooperate, but that didn't work, and my older sister, Ivy Lee, took me under her motherly care. The schoolhouse was only 200 or 300 yards away, so I meekly walked along with my older sibling to satisfy my parents. They thought all was well, but instead of attending class, I went as far as the schoolhouse and then somehow slipped away. We're almost done with this chapter. To crouch in the weeds beside the road on the west side of John Sterling's barn until noon when the students went home for lunch. Then we all returned for afternoon classes except me. I again hid in the grass until school was out. And I went home with my brothers and sisters. That didn't last too long, however. My truancy was reported, and I ended up in school. I don't remember who reported me, but I do remember that frightening first day in school. The school building was right at the front of a steep hill and behind John Sterling's barn. From out of desk, we used to watch John with his team. From our desk, we used to watch John with his big team of mules come and go with his wagon and other equipment. I don't remember all the games we played during recess, but I can still see the boys' one-eyed restroom out behind the extension of a big bluffing cliff. I remember getting my overalls all wet several times when Harrison Allred wouldn't allow me to be excused for a restroom break. That just about scared the life out of me, but I couldn't figure out any alternative. I'm sure he didn't understand my dilemma, or he would have excused me. Oh, how many times we climbed the hill behind her house to spend the day at Grandpa Lawrence's home. Those days were always interesting and fun. The only thing unpleasant I remember about those trips was that Grandpa always made his children wait until the big people ate dinner first, with whetted appetites from running over the hills. That waiting was extremely hard to bear, but that was the custom in those times. I remember a few times when some of us children spent a night at Grandpa's house. One of the outstanding things that got my attention was the early morning crowing of the roosters that roosted in the big sycamore tree behind Grandpa's house. They were very musical voices, and it seemed that every morning they entertained the whole neighborhood with their beautiful crowing. I enjoyed that so much. We enjoyed the other sounds of nature, like the whistling of the bees passing through the pine trees. Their fragrance was vitalizing. I used to be curious about Grandpa's porch custom. He'd sit there by the house, rocking or swinging, and just looking out over the landscape, enjoying God's great out of doors. Perhaps that was his way of passing the time. I can see the beauties and sounds of nature must have attracted him, but still wonder why he did not show more interest in reading or in developing building and other skills, improving their living conditions. But of course, he may have done more than we know about, for we were seldom around when he was doing his work. Today, instead of having any surplus time hanging on our hands, we are always groaning because we don't have enough time to do what we attempted to do. It seems that hours flit by like minutes, and days disappear like hours. Boy, ain't that the truth. And yet, it must have been good therapy for Grandpa and Grandma just to sit and relax and reminiscing on the events of their lives. Then there was Grandpa's sugarcane mill. How interesting it was to see the cane going through two steel press rollers and watch the juice pouring out. It's like we always had sorghum molasses on our table produced from the juice of Grandpa's sugarcane press. We had great times playing with our neighbors' children, U.S. and Maudine Sterling, Gladys, Alfie and Coy Branscombe, Essie, Vernon and Virgil Loaf, Ruth and Oma Isaacs, Elmer and Gus Cooley, along with Jess Sterling's children, Virgil, Lloyd, Myrtle, Ruby, and Bonnie, who were some of our close neighbors. 93, last page, chapter 2. The Isaac family lived up a steep hill above the railway. Their four children were Olivia, Otis, Ruth, and Oma. There was Albert and Emmy Sterling and their children, Cradus, C-R-A-D-U-S, Verla and Verva. I like those names, Verla and Verva. Well, maybe because my name starts with a V, Vincent. Vera Marie was my mother's name, but she went by Judy. Let's see. So the Craddis with his family lived west of us and across the creek. Neither of the girls married, and both died young in their late 20s or early 30s. Don't know what caused their death. Actually, I don't remember Albert, but have a faint recollection that he died when I was still just a few years old. Seems like there were about four homes near where Craddis lived, and I don't remember the names of the other families. It was from one of those homes that I stole a toy, forgotten what it was, when I was maybe 5 years old. Mama discovered what I did and made me take it back. I can't remember whether I took it back or buried it in the sand. Seems like I was caught burying it and returned it to the children. Years later, after I became a Christian, I tried to find out who the family was to apologize and pay for the item. But no one remembered who it was or where they were. It's startling how we get separated from people and completely lose contact with them. And it's amazing how we've come back in this modern day and age of Facebook and all that other stuff that we've been able to find people. It's an amazing day and age that we live in here. Dad's half-sister and Cap Branscombe's wife, Aunt Flurry. Hi, there's a earlier before the show as I was tuning up with a 110-year-old woman named, I believe her name was Flurry. Give some reminiscing. And when I bring all this to the to a landing spot, a page where we'll put all this together, when I eventually share this out to the public beyond this live reading, I'll hope to add some of my discoveries along the way. Let me finish out this chapter here. Well, let's see here. I'm gonna back up just a little bit. Dad's half-sister and Cat Branscombe's wife, Aunt Flurry, lived on Elby's main wagon road. She left an impression on my mind as being the kindest and most generous person in town. She had a very nice personality and was always smiling and laughing. Uncle Cap was a section hand. He worked for the M&NA Railroad Company, and my childhood conception of him was of a very good and dependable person who would not harm anyone in any way. He was killed in an automobile accident. Dad had an he was killed in an automobile. I remember now. He was killed in an automobile accident Dad had in the early 60s, I believe. We had lots of fun. I believe this is the man they're talking about up there in Gentry. When George, was he talking? Is it George's daddy? Well, I might be wrong in all that there. Might be a complete different accident. But he was killed in an automobile accident Dad had in the early 60s, he says, he believes. And we had lots of fun playing with their children, Gladys, Alfie, and Coy. We had great and good neighbors and a wonderful community to live in, even though there were those who got in trouble by drinking and other bad habits. The Lord was so good and protected us through many a danger. Good old days they were. Wonderful. Upright friends, parents, brothers and sisters, and a large family of relatives on both Dad's and Mama's side. But the march of time has brought us to a new day, and that's where we're living now. And time and tide take their toll. But what a bright future awaits those who believe and obey the Lord Jesus Christ. And how we long to see and dwell with our friends and relatives in that land where we'll never grow old. I'll have to bring that him to bear. That brings us to the end of chapter 2 and to page 95 of chapter 3. We're coming to the Barnett line when I pick this back up next week. Chapter 3, the Barnett line. Robert Martin Barnett, Betty Grinder, and Susie Torix. This is an Ozark Heritage. It is the George and Ida Barnett line, compiled by Irma Stevenson. This is second edition, January of 2005. I'm going to go push the button to pause this broadcast, and then I'm going to work to archive it to the record. Thanks for listening. I hope you could bear through with me, and we'll see you next week, or by the time you're hearing this, no doubt. Other than those listening live, it won't be next week. It'll be some weeks from now when this is all done and put together into one place of continual audio, which it's going to take a few hours ahead yet. 2.5 hours last week, and I'm up to 2 hours and 10 minutes this week. And this is where I'll call it quits. Vincent Easley, right here on Half Moon Mountain on October 1st of 2019. Thanks again, folks.